This is Jason Horsley. This is The Liminalist, the podcast between at orticulture.com. I'm now talking to Keith Gordon. Part one of this conversation focuses on Keith's film career. The second part, next Wednesday, will be more of a philosophical conversation about the nature of art and whatnot. Have you listened to this podcast at all?
I have not. I will be honest. I've read stuff that you've written, and there were links into, but I have not specifically listened to the podcast. So I'm a bit of a virgin.
Right. Well, I asked because actually the way we're proceeding is quite normal for the podcast. Like, I don't do interview format or stuff, but just so you know. But in your case, I think I was going to be more focused for a couple of reasons. But anyway, yeah, just so you know, it can be as loose as you like. And also you can talk off the record and, you know, afterwards say, oh, I don't want that to air. Or, I mean, I want you to feel free to speak.
I'm happy to do it, however, and just to catch up and chat and share stories. And you'll use what works for you.
Great. That sounds ideal, yeah. Yeah, well, I was thinking about, you know, our context for meeting. It was at the time I was writing Dogville, and I wanted to write about you in Dogville. You remember I had that website, and I had back when I was really, really into movies a lot more than I am now, kind of come out the other end of that tunnel in many ways. But so I had a page with favorite movies, and I had a list of the most underrated directors and the most overrated directors, and Kubrick was at the top of the overrated and you were at the top of the underrated. You remember that?
I do, and it was very flattering. and no, I mean, you know, there's something about being thought of as underrated that's actually tremendously nice, because it's kind of like, it just feels like you've got somebody who's like in your corner. That's a nice feeling. And when you make odd little movies that not many people see, that's kind of like, that's in a way that I just think somebody can say. So,
yeah, well, I was trying to think what it was to, like, how I first became aware of you in that way as a director, because obviously I was aware of you, I say obviously, maybe it isn't obvious to you, but I was aware of you as an actor. Because Dress to Kill was a big movie for me. Like, I remember first seeing it when I was 13 in the US, and we were traveling with the family, and I was able to see an X, because you wouldn't be able to in the UK, but because of the R system in America, I was able to see it with my mother and my stepfather. And I remember loving the movie and being terrified by it. And in retrospect, I mean, based on having seen it since then, I'm pretty sure I must have heavily identified with your character.
Well, knowing you a little bit and knowing you, having read your writing, I could definitely see a connection.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of me in that character, and I could also see there being a lot of you in that character. I mean, there was something very introverted about him, and very, you know, somebody who processes his brain first, which I tend to have.
A little bit autistic even.
Yeah. And I certainly have that side, and I know that you do. So I'm not surprised that it would have echoed. Now that you bring it up, I mean, that sure.
Yeah, because De Palma, it was an autobiographical character for De Palma too, right?
Yeah, I mean, that was what he had always said, was that, and I think both of the, I mean, I worked with him on that and Home Movies, and they were both, according to him, they were both sort of him. They were both sort of a young him, although he never encouraged me to play him. I mean, he made it clear that he didn't want me to, like, do an imitation of a young Brian De Palma.
Yeah.
That there were elements of the character and the character's situations in both Home Movies and Dress to Kill, but that he wasn't looking for the little him as much as something that captured some essence of the little him, but not, like, somebody, you know. So it wasn't like he wanted me following him around and observing his mannerisms and trying to do them or anything.
Right. So, and how much of you was in that character then, would you say?
Well, a decent amount. I mean, a again, I've always been somewhat introverted. When I was a kid, I was very interested in science. I mean, I was a kid who'd do science projects and do weird things. I mean, younger than that character, my interest moved out of science and into sort of more art very early in my teenage years. But as a little kid, I was always like building computers and getting kits and doing. I was also somebody who, as a kid, ran around New York a lot on my own, which that character did. I didn't have a cool moped when nobody had cool mopeds to do it with, but I was always, now kids, stayed at home, or like everybody's like lives in this much more paranoid, world, right, where kids don't have as much freedom. But when I was a kid in New York, I would just get on the subway when I was 9 or 10 and just go places. So that also seemed familiar to me. And lastly, the fact that he had a certain amount of anger and upset and stuff, but it was all very under the surface, and he tried very hard to kind of keep a lid on things without it being extreme, but it was definitely there. Again, that felt familiar to me. My parents were both very hyper-expressive emotionally and very dramatic, and I think I somewhat went the other way as a personality, because I felt weirded out by how much they would dramatize everything. Although, that said, there are moments where that side of me comes out, because I did grow up with that, and they did sort of teach me that, but I always felt uncomfortable. I mean, they were always saying, oh, go ahead, cry, it's good, you should cry. And at some point it sort of felt like, okay, now this is becoming a demand, So I definitely identified with that kind of slight, and somebody who kind of kept a little bit of a cover on that stuff most of the time.
Yeah, I was just remembering, of course, because your character lost his mother in the course of the movie, so it's actually a very intense performance that you had to summon up for that.
And we, and the idea was to find that emotion underneath, but again, he's not the kid that would be sitting in the police station sobbing.
Yeah.
That he's maybe a little, I mean, you can see it in his eyes, and you can see, but he wouldn't have let that out. He would have kept his guard up, past a certain point. And it comes out almost more in that little scene with Michael Caine. It comes out more in the anger than it comes out in sorrow. That he feels so not trustful of the world, especially now with both parents dead, because he's an orphan, who now only has a stepfather left. So he is really kind of, basically angry, but not ready to let the world see that he's in trouble.
Right. So, and how old were you when you played that role?
I guess it came out in 1980, which probably was 18. Because I think we shot it in 79, which would have meant I was 18. I mean, it's amazing now, this many years later, now that I'm an old guy, mm-hmm. how the chronology of my early years in life and in work can get a little muddy. But if I remember the release date, I can sort of work backwards. And I know that came out in August of 1980, if I remember correctly, in which case I think we shot it the winter before and the fall before. So
you'd have been just 18, maybe.
Yeah.
All right. So how did you end up at 18, like in a massive production with Brian De Palma and Michael Caine? Was that pretty disorienting for you, or did you just take it in your stride?
Oh, it was thrilling. I wouldn't say disorienting. I was excited because I'd already done a film with Brian. I did Home Movies, which was
it's before that, right?
Yeah, Home Movies was before it, which was that this very weird little experimental film.
Yeah, I like it. It's one of my favorites of his.
Well, it was really fun to work on, and I'm sure you know the story of it. But the whole crew were students. Basically Brian was teaching filmmaking at Sarah Lawrence, and decided the only real way to show how you make an independent movie was to make one, that it was too hard to just talk about it in theory or,
Right.
So basically he took out an old story of his, and he had some of the students write a script from it, and really almost the entire crew were non-professionals. They were the students in the class. There were a couple, the DP was a young professional DP, but almost everybody, the art department, the crew, were his class. And while it was messy at times, it was also wonderful. I mean, what people didn't have in knowledge, they made up with enthusiasm, and it was really fun. It was like not like any other movie or work experience I've ever had. And I was, at that point, even younger, I was like 17. So for me, it was really cool because I was like hanging out with the older cool kids. You know, suddenly it was me and a bunch of college students.
Right.
And, you know, I was chasing the girls and I was, it was great. It was a really fun experience. So that, but when Brian asked me to do Dress to Kill, I was already very comfortable with him. I was very comfortable with Nancy Allen, who had been in home movies with me. I was excited, but I was less nervous than I would have been otherwise. It also happened sort of so oddly because the character originally is written in Dress to Kill was younger. He was like 12. And Brian had been seeing a lot of younger kids and not feeling it was really working. He'd been auditioning a bunch of kids who were 4 or 5 years younger than me and just felt like it wasn't happening for him somehow, whether it was the humor of it or whatever. So he kind of had this idea of, well, what if I made him a little older? And so then I came in and read, but Brian was very like, look, this is probably not going to happen. You're much older than my concept of the character. So I just wanted to hear you read it, but, you know, don't get too excited. So I also kind of went, which helped me very relaxed. It was like, all right, well, whatever, let's go. And, but I think in the end, he decided that by making him older, it brought out some other colors that he liked. And there's some subtle sexual overtone to some of the jokes and the relationship with Nancy and the weirdness of the stuff and the Peter joke with the mom. I mean, suddenly things had a little bit more meaning. He was really an adolescent as opposed to a pre-adolescent when he was just like an innocent, cute kid. And I think that was, if I remember correctly, that was the thing he felt with most of the kids he was reading, is that it got too cutesy. And, you know, Brian, the one thing Brian isn't is cutesy.
Yeah, well, I remember. I mean, the tension for me, and it's just occurring to me now, but I had a record of falling in love with older women in my adolescence and teen years because, well, not just because, but because I have an older sister. That was mainly the reason, I think. And that was a big part of the, for me, the interest and the tension in Dress to Kill was this possibility of some sexual element between you and Nancy Allen, absolutely.
Yeah, no, I like that, and it was fun finding that. And she and I had fun playing with that, and doing takes where it was a little bit more overt, and then other takes where it was a little bit more buried. And you know, that was definitely a fun thing to play with that became part of the dynamic. You know, and what does it mean when I say come stay at the house with me? What does it mean when, you know, Mike's out of town, come stay at the house? And you know, and yes, I come running in from the other room, and we're both in pajamas. But there's definitely this like, you don't know that anything ever happened, or but it's, yeah, she's this gorgeous hooker and I'm a lonely, horny, like 16-year-old kid. So there is this strange undertone. Yeah, that was definitely something that was fun to play with. And sometimes it's, look, for always as an actor, and I guess for anybody when you're working on or writer when you're working on a script or a book, or you know, it's sometimes it's the things that aren't the obvious and that aren't really, that are just subtones and the most interesting things to play with. I mean, if for an actor particularly, something that's not written into a script, but discover that you can add into it can sometimes be the best parts of it. You know, I've had that experience as a director. I've also as an actor, but I also have had it as a writer or a director, where an actor has said, "Well, I really think this character is whatever is gay, or I think this character is this, or I think," and it was not part of the script. But I kind of go, "Well, that's interesting, and that adds something." And yeah, maybe we never even say it, or maybe, but maybe it's just something we know. As that you and I know as a sort of artistic agreement, and if and however it colors stuff, it does. And those are often those sort of hidden secret subtexts are, I think, sometimes can really make the difference in making a performance have a lot more going on, even if the audience doesn't know quite what it is, but you sense that there's other layers happening.
Yeah, those are, I think, often the moments in films that hold up the best as well. I mean, thinking even specifically with Dress to Kill, I think those quieter moments between the characters hold up much better than the big set pieces and the horror stuff, actually.
I agree with that. And I feel that often about Brian's work. I mean, you know, the set pieces are, look, he's very impressive technically, but I think he's underrated for the fact that he's good with actors. I mean, he was a good director of actors. I mean, people always were like, "Oh, he must have just been really technical." It's like, no, he really wasn't. He was actually very articulate and communicative about what he felt was going on in the scenes. He was very encouraging of a certain kind of experimentation with the emotions of the scenes. You know, I think it was much more of a focus for him than probably most people would have assumed. He seemed really interested in performance and in actors, and he's had a history of casting like really good actors. I mean, he's had a lot of people in his sort of stock company who do some really good work. And he gives you a lot of freedom. I mean, even as a young actor, he gave me room to try stuff, and he'd be very encouraging. In fact, there were things I stole from him as a director. And he had a tendency to get a take and then feel like, oh, and he would say basically, well, we got that version. We got the angry version. Let me see one that's more of a seduction scene. Okay, well, we got that. Maybe let's try one that's more kind of playful and fun. And for an actor, that was great because you never felt like it just had to be done one way and it had to be. You always knew that you'd get, because often when you're acting, you got little things in the back of your brain going, well, what if I did this? What if I did that? And with somebody like Brian, you kind of knew you'd have the chance to try them all out. He didn't, he tended to do a lot of takes, which I really liked. But it wasn't a lot of takes in search of like this perfection that you had to just get right. He seemed to like to have choices in the editing room in terms of performance.
Right.
And I mean, every actor's so different, but for me, that was really enjoyable because you got to try stuff.
So, how soon did you actually set out to be an actor then?
Well, my path was sort of odd and wandering. I grew up around it because my parents were both in theater, and my dad also did some work in television and film, but mostly theater, and also did a lot of commercials and voiceovers to pay the rent. But they'd both been part of like Compass, which became Second City. But they were part of it when it was back early on. It was Mike Nichols and Elaine May and Barbara Harris, and so they came from a theater tradition. So I was always around theater and stuff, but I'd never really thought seriously about doing it. I was a big movie buff from very early on. When I was a kid, my dad took me to 2001. I know you have your Kubrick problem, but that film was a turning point for me because I was 8 years old when it came out, or seven, I guess. And it was 68, so I would have been seven. And I didn't understand it, but it blew my mind that I didn't understand it. Because he thought he was taking me to like a rocket ship movie, and if we went opening weekend, so nobody really knew what it was. And he just said, oh, it's like rockets. And I went, and I was like, I didn't know what it was, but I knew that I didn't know. And that kind of blew my mind and made me want to see it like 50 times. So I dragged poor father back over and over again. And that started me loving the idea of movies and storytelling where you're not, where you have to think about things. I thought that was like the coolest thing, that like I couldn't just explain everything. And that started kind of a lifelong passion. And so as a kid, I used to go to movies all the time. All of my friends, we were all into movies. So we'd go to both theater and film, but film particularly a lot. And then when I got to be like 12 or 13, I started working in the Museum of Modern Art in the film archives after school, which was just basically just filing stuff. I mean, that was back before microfiche had even really come in. They were just getting it. So they would get articles on films and reviews from all over the country and all over the world. And they had these gigantic, filing system, and I would just file these articles away. And in exchange, they would like run movies for me occasionally, or tell me about movies, or tell me stories. And it was really terrific. It was really, really fun. So I was already a big film buff, and then I started making really bad Super 8 movies. I saved up and bought a Bauer Super 8 camera, which I still have on my wall. And with all my friends, we do like short stories and comedy bits and serious stuff, and it was all awful, and most of it ended up unfinished. I mean, there's still in backs of closets there were reels of uncut or semi-cut stuff, but it was really fun, and it sort of got me really interested in films and filmmaking. And then the school got a video camera, and I basically completely hijacked that. And so I wasn't really focused on acting. I was more excited about filmmaking. And then as luck has it in life, and so much of life is, to my experience, is random and strange. And I was in a school play, and somebody saw it, and they said, I know somebody who's looking for a kid your age for a professional play, and they're having real trouble casting it. And there's something about you, I think it might be right for this part. Would you go read for it? And so I went and I read for it, and I actually got the job. And so then I got to go to the National Playwrights Conference at the Eugene O'Neill Theater in Connecticut, which is a summer thing they do every year, where it's what the Sundance Institute was sort of based on this. It was a good place. Sundance is for filmmakers to go and develop their work, and the National Playwrights Conference was playwrights would take their plays up there with like wonderful actors, and dramaturgs, and they would basically workshop the play as a stage reading for like a couple of weeks, and then present it for some audiences, and they'd be rewriting all through the process. And that was my first gig. And then doing that, somebody saw it, and I got an agent out of it. And I just had this life that started going where I was ridiculously lucky and able to go back and forth between working in theater and working in film. I got cast in Jaws 2, which was a horrible movie, and didn't have much to do. Sorry, my throat is terrible. So,
Were you the son of Roy Scheider's son? Or
no, I was just Jaws 2, and there was a whole bunch of kids,
yeah.
and were caught out on a raft in the middle of the ocean, and I was one of the kids.
Right.
And I was on it for 10 months, and I had about 10 lines. But it was,
Wow, that's crazy.
but consequently, it became an amazing learning experience. Because I only had so much to do as an actor, so and there was nothing else. We were shooting in the northern panhandle of Florida, which, if you've never been there, you're lucky. And we were at a Holiday Inn in the middle of nowhere, and so really, there's nothing to do except be on the set all day, even when I wasn't working. And so, for somebody who wanted to learn about films and filmmaking, it was great. I mean, I just went and watched all day. They had an editing room in the hotel. I'd go hang out in the editing room all day. So.
They didn't mind.
No. It was there. People were very. Everybody was bored out of their skulls being there. So, and I think they could tell that I was very passionate. So, if anything, they were very welcoming. Neil Travis was the editor, and he was really nice about showing me what they were doing and why they were doing it. And basically, everybody was that way. The directors, the DPs. I mean, once they caught on that I was really, really interested and wanted to do the things they did, people were really nice about letting me bother them and follow them around and look at things and ask questions. And I even basically directed one of my own little second unit shots. I set up the camera. So it was really, really exciting, and that became a bit of a template for me. That became a template for me. I mean, once I realized that people would be actually willing to and often excited about sharing what they do and how and why. All the projects I did as an actor, I did that with Brian. I just hung around. I went every day on Dress to Kill. If I wasn't in the scene, I'd go and watch, and I'd just sit there quietly and see what the actors were doing and what he was doing. And I'd ask him about lighting, and I'd ask him about where he was putting the camera. And I'd go to the editing room. I went to the editing room more on home movies. But I was lucky in that I got to work with a lot of people who were very kind. Brian let me go to all of the dailies. A lot of directors are defensive about that, so especially with a younger actor. But he got that I was really interested in learning about it, and he's like, "No, just come to the dailies, see what we did, see how." So it was an amazing, amazing learning experience, and all of my work as an actor became film school. And even when I did theater, I worked with really some amazing directors where. They would really talk with me. Michael Bennett spent a lot of time talking to me about directing actors, the stuff that I got out of that experience has stuck with me ever since.
Which film was that?
Michael Bennett was theater. That was something else.
Oh, right.
Michael was mostly known for Chorus Line and Dreamgirls and all these like huge Broadway. But I was in a little three-character play, that one-act play that he directed. Which was not what he was most famous for, but he was like the biggest director in Broadway theater at that time. And what was amazing working with him was that we were three young actors. The play was about three young guys on their last night of high school getting stoned together in a graveyard. The three best friends, and they kind of all know that after this night they're going to go their separate ways, and the end of an era sort of happening. It's a sweet little play written by a young playwright. And Michael came in. Michael was God in theater in New York, and he could have directed us however he wanted. And instead, what was clear was that he was figuring us out. He was figuring out what each of us needed as actors. And we were all three very different actors. We had very different levels of experience. We came from very different modes of performance. And Michael's focus was on what we needed instead of on how he did things. And that was a big lesson. To have somebody like be that generous of spirit and know that that was the best way to get what he wanted was to find out how he could best work with us. And that's something that stayed with me ever since.
So, did you have any training then?
Did I?
Yeah.
Not formal. I mean, again, I grew up around it a lot. My dad taught as well as directed and acted in theater. And so, when you grow up with a teacher who's very passionate, and my father, if nothing else, was incredibly passionate, it's like growing up with a father who's a rabbi or a pastor or something. I mean, you're either going to run screaming or you're going to pick up a lot. Because it was a big subject at home. I mean, even when I wasn't trying to be an actor, he'd talk about acting and theater and storytelling, and then once he knew I was interested at all, he just wanted to talk. That was all he wanted to do, was talk about, scripts and this and how you break things down. And so I got a lot of tutoring. Sometimes I didn't want it. He could be very intense. But certainly, and he gave me books to read, and he was constantly, whether it was Stanislavski or Chekhov or this, he was just always giving me things to look at and to read. And so I had that, but I did not have the usual kind of training. I never took formal acting classes. I never took directing classes of any kind. But I don't know, when I was lucky enough to I was sitting in an editing room with Brian De Palma and say, "Well, why are you putting this shot next to that shot?" That's in some ways the best class you could have. So I feel
Sure.
like I was really lucky. I got like the best schooling you could get.
Yeah, and you went from De Palma to John Carpenter, right?
I did. I mean, and I also, I mean, look, I worked, and also I worked with Joan Nicholas Silver in theater, and she was a wonderful teacher of how to deal with actors. I worked with Bob Fosse, who didn't want to play the role of teacher with me, but did let me kind of quietly follow around, not ask too many questions, but watch.
What
But
was your role in all that jazz?
oh, I played the young Roy Scheider who ends up coming in his pants, like when he's molested by the strippers. Basically there's a flashback to when he was a kid who used to tap dance in clubs, and it was very intense and very weird. I mean, I was still pretty young. I think that was the same year I did Dressed to Kill, No, it was actually earlier. So I think I was 17 when I did that.
Yeah.
And it was like, you know, and they were real strippers, and it was really freaky, you know, for somebody who was a kid.
It's funny because I had the brain fart about you being Roy Scheider's son, but actually it was pretty close. Cause,
It's true.
and he was in Jaws too,
And
right?
he was in
So
both.
you already knew him.
Yes.
So it's like you, yeah. That's.
Yeah, although, you know, we never got to act together much in either, but you know, yeah, I liked him a lot. And although he was not a happy guy on Jaws 2, because he did not want to be there, and it went on for
I
forever.
think I heard that. He was contractually obliged, right?
Yep, that's yeah. The other guys were not. I mean, well, Robert Shaw's character was dead, but Dreyfuss wasn't,
Yeah.
and Roy had to be there, and you know, and it was a horrendous, legendary mess of a production. So, you know, they were weeks and weeks into it when they fired the first director, and then they threw out all the footage and they started over. I mean, so it just went on and on and on, and then there were hurricanes that blew down sets, and they were, so it became this, for a usual film, epically long project, and Roy didn't want to be there in the first place, so by the end he was just miserable. And he was very professional in terms of doing the role, but it was clear like he did not want to be there. And he was very nice to us, the other actors. I think it was more conflict with the director, the producers, you know, where he was like, I don't want to be here at all. So,
Right.
but yeah, then I worked with John Carpenter on Christine, and John was great. John, I loved. John was, again, another, John was a teacher more by example than, because like Brian's very heady. Brian and me could sit and talk intellectually for hours. John's not a guy who's going to like sit and talk as much. But he was very welcoming again to just watch over his shoulder and see what he's doing, and you know, and he was happy to talk. It just wasn't his thing as much, you know. He wanted he'd rather do stuff. But I love the way he ran the set. It was really Christine was probably the most fun acting job I ever had. It was just great to go to work every day.
Yeah, well, seeing the character must have been a lot of fun because you got the most extreme character arc, right? You go from the nerd to the psychopath in the course of one movie, right?
Yeah, it was Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde,
Yeah.
and that was really fun.
Well, you probably won't know about this book I wrote, Seen and Not Seen. I mean, you may have heard of it, but it's about how. It's difficult to describe, but essentially it came about organically through my relationship with Jonathan Liebstam and writing about him and seeing the parallels with his obsession with pop culture and my obsession. Like we had intersecting obsessions like David Byrne and Talking Heads and Philip K. Dick and The Searchers, John Ford movie, and various things there that kind of resonated and, you know. Made me aware of an affinity between us, but also like his understanding of the way that he'd been shaped by pop culture helped me to see more clearly that in my own life. And so, Seen or Not Seen, it evolved out of that and it included me looking back over my old writings, The Blood Poets, the books I published in 1999 about violence in movies. And re-evaluating my own evaluations and kind of discovering more and more the extent to which my identity had been shaped by culture as an adolescent, as a teenager, and most specifically movies. Like in that key period in my life, and particularly being autistic in quotes, you know, just being neurodeviant, what have you, and not really being able to find a way of being in society that seemed to fit. I was looking for, you know, anything I could find, any clues and any tools I could find anywhere at all, and the pop culture and movies was the place that I went most persistently. So it was like I was building this identity, mostly unconsciously, but somewhat consciously, out of the movies that I was watching. And so, Seen and Not Seen was this process of this attempt to deconstruct that identity to find out, you know. What I was without it, you know, who I really was without all these cultural implants. So it's interesting for me to talk to you in that context because, well, I mean, part of the identity I created, a big part of it was this desire to be a Hollywood filmmaker because this was the way to somehow to try and extend this more passive identity, movie-created identity, into an active role, like I would actually make the movies that would influence other people rather than just be passively influenced. So there's that, number one, like you're the only sort of Hollywood film director I've really managed to strike up a relationship with. Obviously, that's meaningful to me. And then there's the fact that your movies have influenced me. Not so much as a director, because I was much older by then. But these movies that we're talking about now, as I say, I mean, there were dozens of movies, right? But I can see that Dressed to Kill was definitely a very significant one in the those few dozen movies. And Christine, even because of my Stephen King infatuation. And I just remember the role of, was it Arnie or Archie?
Arnie, yeah.
Arnie. Just, I mean, it was tailored, as same as the Dressed to Kill role, but even more, it was tailored to appeal to frustrated adolescent males, right? It's a fantasy role.
Sure.
So absolutely, I hooked into that. Then the third thing was Static, which I think I told you in an email or two, and because nobody's heard of Static now, I couldn't even find a torrent for it. But that movie had an impact on me. I think I told you I watched it, and the whole way through. Okay, so I'll just sum it up for people if they don't know. But this is, you're playing this character who's an inventor, which is like the Dress to Kill role. And when I was a kid, I wanted to be a mad inventor. Don't ask me why. It was because maybe an autistic thing, like I wanted to use my mind in some special way. So also in Static, you play this mad inventor who believes he's come up with a device for seeing heaven. That's right, more or less, isn't
Yep,
it?
that's absolutely right.
Heaven was my favorite Talking Heads song as well, so somehow
Well,
I know.
that was definitely an influence on us when we were doing. Yeah,
Oh, was it?
I think if we'd had the budget, we would have tried to get that movie song in the movie.
Right.
We knew that there was no way it would happen, but Mark Romanek, who directed the film, and we wrote it together, and that song was definitely one that was played much during, around that time.
Wow, now I'm getting chills. So I watched the movie. I would have been, when did it come out? 86 or something?
That sounds right, yeah, I think so.
85,
85,
86,
86,
yeah.
yeah.
I was 19, so this was a period in my life. It was kind of the low point in my life. I didn't realize it. I'd inherited a fortune from my family, which meant I could do exactly what I wanted to. And what I wanted to do, basically, before I moved to New York, which was the culmination of the dream, was just sit around all day, stay in bed all day, and then get up at 4 in the afternoon, smoke pot, and watch movies all night, and then go to
That doesn't sound bad. I gotta say,
So that, yeah,
I could see that. It's
it works for a while, right?
yeah.
And that was the period I saw Static, and so right in fully ensconced in that lifestyle. And so I would see just about everything, and I didn't see it for any particular reason. I wasn't a Keith Gordon fan or anything, but at least I recognized you, and I wanted to see it just because. I would watch anything, and I watched the movie, and all the whole way through, I was thinking, yeah. I don't like this. Is kind of, I just kept watching it because it was intriguing. But I was basically had decided by the end pretty much that I didn't like it. It wasn't a very good movie. But then it has, well, the ending. I don't know if it matters to give it away because no one can see it.
Right.
So he unveils his device, which. He's so excited about it because it's going to prove to everyone, it's going to make it, the whole world happy, because they're going to be able to see that there's life after death, that life has meaning. He unveils his device, just an ordinary TV set, and no one else can see what he can see. It's just static, right?
Yeah.
And then there's this very dramatic ending, which I think I even thought, even while it was happening, I was still thinking this isn't working, and there's this explosive ending. Everybody dies practically, and I was thinking, why did they do that? It just didn't work. It was just crazy. And then I don't know at what point, but the credits roll, whatever. But somehow, it all just came together, and I just started weeping, like I was just sitting in front of the TV, just sobbing my eyes out. And after that, I loved the movie. I just thought that is one of the great movies for me. Like it somehow it reached me at this incredibly deep level, which I don't know if I analyzed it or not. I probably did, because actually I was always pretty analytical. But it was the poignancy of this quest for meaning, and the quest to somehow deliver something that would relieve people's suffering, and the discovery that it was so utterly subjective that there was no way to communicate it to anyone else. I mean, now I am just, I don't know if that's how I interpret it now, but then, but that's how I'm interpreting it now.
No, those are certainly, that's about as nice a way of framing the themes as I've ever heard. I mean, that sort of everything you just said certainly speaks to, I think, emotionally what I feel like that movie's about. So,
And you co-wrote it, we should say, right?
right.
So.
Mark had the initial, basically, Mark had been one of the students. Not, I mean, he wasn't a student at Sarah Lawrence, but he worked on home movies. He was a second AD. He had been a PA on The Fury for Brian. So he heard he was doing this movie with all these students, and he was like, well, could I come be like one of the students and work on the movie? So he became the second assistant director. And then he and I struck up a friendship. We just had a lot of things that we liked in common. It was that, including Talking Heads. And just he, after I was finished with home movies, we kind of stayed good friends. And he finally called me one day and he said, I have an idea for a film, and I don't know what. I just There's a guy in the desert, and he works in a crucifix factory, like where plastic crucifixes come off the line, and he collects all the ones that are screwed up and that don't look right. And he has some kind of invention, and then there's a model in town that he's in love with, and I don't know anything else, but and that was where we started from. And then over time, the model became Amanda Plummer's character wasn't a model at all. But we just kind of started throwing ideas back and forth. And really, it was kind of wonderful fun. I mean, we just had 18,000 Chinese food lunches where we would just throw ideas around. And I'd write a scene, he'd write a scene, and we'd take them and rewrite each other's scenes. And then it took forever to get the money, which it always does. But it was really fun. It was really, working with friends is a great thing. And I was sad the film never found an audience here. It did okay, actually, in England. I mean, it actually played for a number of weeks in London.
Yeah, to get reviewed and everything.
No, the reviews in England were amazing. England was really the place that seemed to get it. In America, the reviews were very mixed. There were some people who loved it, and some people who hated it, and some people were just indifferent. But it never had a real theatrical life here. The company that owned it basically was or it was in terrible financial trouble when they went to put it out, so they didn't have any money to put it out with, which was just sort of frustrating. We also got sort of screwed because Sheila Benson, who was then the lead critic for the LA Times, really loved the film and actually wrote this amazing little capsule review of it when it was at a film festival. But when the company that owned the theatrical rights decided to open it in LA, she was on vacation, which meant that we didn't get a review from her, which would have been like a rave based on everything, And we
Right.
got a different critic there who was gave us a kind of a lukewarm review. It wasn't mean. I mean, it was kind of positive, but wasn't a review that was going to make anybody run out and see it. And that was a really big blow because the thought had been that we'd have the LA Times behind it out here, and that would kind of get people aware of it. And once that didn't happen, the people putting it out lost interest pretty quickly in trying to make much more of an effort with it.
Right.
Just,
Yeah, you were ju it was just at the start of the independent wave, wasn't it? Right at the beginning
Yeah, it
of
was actually before the independent wave had gotten to be big. Nobody, it was, I mean, there were John Sayles' Return of the Secaucus 7. There were films that were coming out that were getting attention for being indie, but it hadn't had that breakthrough yet where people went, wow, you can make a lot of money with these movies. So that the companies putting them out were still really small, were still really, family route operations or whatever, that running on a shoestring. And it was just kind of catching on. And it was actually a really nice time. In some ways, that was my favorite time in the indie film movement because once, Sex, Lies, and Videotape happened, and they realized, oh my God, we can take a film that was made for nothing and it can earn $80 million at the box office. That became a big part of like the psychology of it. Before that, it was like a little doing theater in a little tiny theater somewhere. You knew it was never going to get that much attention, but that wasn't the point. But once people realized, oh no, these things can take off, and then it got even more crazy when the Tarantino film happened.
Reservoir Dogs.
No, not even Reservoir Dogs. Reservoir Dogs was still kind of more like it never didn't make that much money. It was
Pulp Fiction.
Pulp Fiction. That
Yeah.
was the first indie film I think to break 100 million. And then after that, it was like all I'd ever do is have meetings with people saying, "We want the next Pulp Fiction." And I was like, "Oh my God, now indies have just become a studio thing in a
It
way."
wasn't even indie, but by that point,
Right.
Bruce Willis, John Travolta, it's that's not indie, right?
But psychologically, that became everybody's goal, you know, and it sort of really shifted that part of the world here. But yeah, we were still at a point like it played at what became the Sundance Film Festival. It was called the US Film Festival back then, but it was the film festival in, you know, up in Park City. And at that point, nobody went there. When we were there, it was static. It was like the theaters were like basically empty, and it was just all the filmmakers wandering around getting drunk on beer and hanging out together. And, you know, no one knew about it except, and the local people from Salt Lake City who wanted to see movies. And we'd all hang out together. And that was really great. It like wasn't like a thing yet.
So how happy were you with Static then, with the result, I mean, the film itself, I mean?
I really like it. I was happy with it then, and I still do. I mean, I see flaws in it, and you know, I always see flaws in anything I'm involved with. But it's funny; it's very sad because Mark Romanek has really disowned it. He really dislikes it, and feels it's juvenile and embarrassing, and you know that technically it's a mess, and so he part of why it's not accessible is because he doesn't want it out there, and it's his film.
Has he done any other features?
Yeah, he's done a couple more. He did 1 Hour Photo,
Oh yeah, that's
and
right.
he did Never Let Me Go.
The vampire. Was that the vampire thing?
No, that's no. This was it was with the sort of young adult science fiction-y thing with Andrew Garfield and Keira Knightley, and you know about kids who are basically being raised to be organ donors and.
I guess that one passed me by. So I guess he doesn't want that to be his first film, when it
No,
comes down to.
strange. I mean, he basically doesn't talk about it, and he doesn't. And it's frustrating because I've had people come to me who really love it and who wanted to put it out on video and said, "Could you help convince him?" And he just isn't interested.
Why doesn't he just put what's the name on Smithy? Make it an Alan Smithy film.
Well, I think with indie movies that doesn't really work the same way. He wants to see it, knows about why, you know. But it's just too bad. I mean, I think he does himself a disservice, and that I think he did a great job, and I think he made a really amazing film. And the number of people like you who talked to me about having had very intense emotional reactions to that film is very high, and I think that he really deserves the credit for that. And like I said, the reviews in London were amazing, and you know, I think I don't know why he's decided it's not good. I don't really understand it, but Mark is nothing if not strong-willed. And once he decided it wasn't something he was proud of, he just didn't want it out there. And, you know, I have to respect that, and I love him as a person, but I do think that he, you know, yeah, sure, there's places where you can see it probably as a young filmmaker, or something might be a little bit on the nose, or this. I mean, it's far from a perfect movie, but I think it shows a lot of talent, and more importantly, I think it seems to really touch a lot of people. And I'm sort of sorry that it's so inaccessible.
Yeah. Does it have a lot of him in personally, do you think? Is that part of it?
That's a really interesting question. I mean, I do think there's a lot of his heart. When we were making it, certainly there was a lot of his heart in that movie. And there is, I mean, he's definitely a part of that character that I played along with me. I mean, I think Ernie was some of Mark and some of me and some of neither of us. But I never thought about maybe that was why he was backed away from it. I don't know if that's the case, but it's an interesting question.
I mean, it would make sense as a reason, even if it wasn't fully conscious.
Yeah, I truly believe that consciously that's not the reason. I mean, I think when we've talked about it, it's really more that he feels like that it's just both on a filmmaking level and on a storytelling level that it's very adolescent. That's the thing he always talks about being juvenile or adolescent. And
Juvenilia. Well, even Kubrick's Juvenilia is still available. I think
yeah,
he
I,
made.
well, so, well, he tried to stop. I
He
mean,
did try and stop it, yeah.
Fear and Desire only really showed up years after his death, except those of us who were interested found it on like weird bootlegged,
Right.
you know, DVDs or actually VHS. I saw a weird bootleg VHS. That was how I finally saw it. But yeah, I think so. You know, Kubrick was somebody who tried to bury an early film, and I think Mark has had some of that same thing. I mean, if it wasn't up to his standards, he didn't want people to see it. It's funny because Mark spent a lot of his career doing videos, you know, rock videos and commercials, and I mean, he's probably one of the very, very short list of best video makers ever. And in a way, it's such videos are such miniatures that you can make them perfect. You know, you can just kind of hone them till like there's nothing you don't like in them. It's much harder in a feature because it goes on long, you know, to have it be everything you want it to be. But you know, I do think his other films are really strong. I mean, I think it's sad that he hasn't gotten to do more movies because I think he's a really good filmmaker. And some of it's just been luck. Some of it's that he is enough of a perfectionist that my sense is that he hasn't wanted to do things if he couldn't do them the way he wanted to. I know he walked away from some projects where, when he felt like once it became compromised, he was not interested. But it's always strange because I feel like, you know, he's really good and has a lot to say. And I hope he gets to do still. I mean, he's still work out there working, so.
Well, yeah, I have books that I kind of wish went out there. Actually, Dogville's one of them, and just because it was very haphazardly slapped together, and I just obviously wasn't paying attention. But I also think it's kind of a bit egotistical of me to want it, or it would be if I wanted to withdraw all evidence of my flaws, as if they're not going to show up in the later stuff anyway. But I mean that it's all part of an arc or a curve of development as a writer or a filmmaker or whatever, and in a way it's kind of like to try and conceal one's roots. I mean, that's what politicians do, right? They want to create this perfect background, and in a way I feel it's better that people who do read my stuff now, that they do have access to this stuff and that they can see how much I've changed and developed since then.
Well, I really feel that way. Forget as an artist, I feel that way as a somebody who observes. Yeah, if I like somebody's work, whatever it is, whether it's writing, filmmaking, painting, but you know, the second I respond to someone, I want to see that. I want to see that arc of growth of their career. I often, if a musician, or whatever, I'll always like to go back and what are the first things that you can find of theirs, and you know, even if they really are awful. I mean, it doesn't matter. It's interesting to me. You know, it's.
Yeah.
Because
Touching, yeah.
art doesn't exist, I guess, for me in a vacuum. I mean, part of
Yeah.
what's interesting about an artist is that evolution. So yeah, I'm very much I agree with you, and like, you know, I feel like that's the fun part of falling in love with an artist.
Funny because that's actually my bone with Kubrick we're getting to now is I feel that he tried to mythologize himself, that he was very determined to create this aura around him of this great genius, and that's actually my bone with 2001, is I think the whole thing was a vehicle just designed to cast a spell over people and elevate him up socially. I don't think it was only that, but I think there was a very strong element of that. So it's kind of self-propagandizing, and that would be confirmed by him, like, because Fear and Desire and those early movies, ideally, they're very inspiring to people who love Kubrick because they can see, oh, well, he wasn't always Kubrick. He was once just a guy just trying to figure out what the hell he was doing, right? But so to want to erase all traces of that is a disservice, I think.
Well, and I do think there are a lot of people who are artists that do feel that. They feel that if you see behind, I mean, I definitely agree with you about Kubrick and seeming very, you know, creating a public persona and creating a way that he wanted to be perceived. But I feel like a lot of artists do that. A lot of artists really have a way they want you to see them, and they don't like anything that doesn't play to that narrative. And I think that's too bad because I think that means you're hiding some of who you are and in turn hiding some of your art. But I don't think it's unusual. I feel like, you know, so many people are defensive and only want you to see this side of them. And you know, in some ways, not in art, in life. You know, let's think of how many people that, you know, only want to very carefully control even just how the people that they know perceive them. It's one of the struggles of being a human being that I think a lot of people try to control what everybody else thinks about them, and that immediately creates an artificiality that is really hard to live in the world with.
Two more hours, the sun will shine. Got the future on my mind. the city in the dark. Something saw on the radio about 100 miles to go. Had to leave it all behind just to know what's left to find. I think I see what I've been looking for. Been looking for all these years. Got this feeling in my heart, hoping I don't fall apart. 'Cause it's happened here before. Soon the stars will disappear and my view will start to clear. It's an endless road of dreams, crossing too much in between. I think I see I've been looking for. Been looking for all these years. I think I see I've been looking for. I've been looking for all these years. All comes back to the man I once knew. Heart of the golden kind. Looking back in the rear view, fading off in the dark blue, the pieces of a scattered mind. It's all in a life worth to the end of time. Wanna see my home again, wanna find my long lost friends, wanna feel that prairie wind. There's a long road still ahead. I've been thinking about what you said. I hope it all was true. If my road leads back to you, I think I see what I've been looking for. Been looking for all these years. I think I see I've been looking for. I've been looking for all these years.
I think, I don't remember now, but I think it was part of my thesis, if that's not too fancy a term, when I was writing about you and your work, was to do with this, that it seemed to me there was a willingness in your approach to filmmaking, and perhaps acting too, to not use it as in the way that we're talking to. There was an accessibility about it. And of course I had that experience because I emailed you and you got back to me, and I hadn't had that experience with people working in the industry before. Generally, it's unusual in and of itself, but I felt that communicates in the work that you've done as well, that there's a kind of willingness to just be to be on the same level as the audience and not to be using the art as a cloak or an engine of your own aggrandizement.
Well, that's thank you, because I that's how I want to be, and but I also it is how I feel. I mean maybe if I was a great genius I would feel differently, but I don't perceive myself that way. I mean, I think that I have talents and things that I do well, but I don't think I'm some special person that maybe Shakespeare or maybe there's a handful of artists in human history that, and I don't really believe this, but in some ways they're they're kind of superhuman, and I don't really think that. But for most of us, it's something we just do. I like telling stories on film. It's fun. It's interesting to me. But I do it to share it with people. And if I'm good at it in some ways, then great. But, to me, it's not about making myself feel like, oh, boy, I'm so special. It's about something that's really interesting and fun to do that I like to share with people. And I like to see what they think. And even if they don't like it, I mean, I've learned a lot, even from bad, I don't mind smart bad reviews. When somebody's critical, but they actually make points where I go, oh, that's a good point, and I see that. I feel grateful for that. So, but that's just me. I've just never felt special in that way, nor have I felt the desire to feel that way. I don't want to feel this is what I do, and other people, and my father-in-law does beautiful pieces of furniture out of wood, and people just do different things, and I don't like the Hollywood thing that has tried to elevate people who make movies into something different. I think that's really weird and disturbing societally, and I don't think it's good for the art form either.
It's absolutely because it. I mean, the more that success distances the artist from just ordinary human interaction, the less they're able to really represent ordinary human interaction in their work, right? So back to Kubrick again, I felt he got more and more removed from just ordinary human existence, and his movies became more and more about grand statements, let's say. I don't think I consciously juxtaposed you and Kubrick, but certainly the thing that I like about your work, the films that I particularly like, which were Midnight Clear, Mother Night, Singing Detective, I think those are the three that really, really struck something for me, was how much you seem to be involved with the characters and their experiences, as compared to Kubrick, who I never felt really cared about his characters at all. So, for me, A Midnight Clear was... I don't like putting labels on stuff, so I wouldn't even say that was an anti-war movie. It was a movie about war, human beings in war, but you could frame it as an anti-war movie if you wanted, right?
Sure.
And far more effective than A Full Metal Jacket, on a different level to me, because you were dealing with human beings and human relations in the context of war, and so we're involved. We're experiencing it from the inside.
Well, yeah, they're very different. I mean, look, I am a Kubrick fan, so
I know.
I love Full Metal Jacket, but yes, it's not operating at all the same. I mean, if anything, I was much more influenced, for example, with Midnight Clear, I was much more influenced by Paths of Glory, which was a much more humanistic film.
Yeah.
And earlier in Kubrick's career, when he was more focused on human behavior and on more abstracted ideas and abstracted characters. I mean, I've tried my best, and maybe it's a reaction to my dad, because my dad, was as an artist, was one of those artists who would always rip himself asunder, and it always seemed both crazy and really sad to me. I mean, he was a very unhappy guy in his work, and he was a perfectionist and basically despised a lot of what he was doing and a lot of himself in it, and often would be angry at the other people, and it always seemed crazy to me. I'm like, what a sad way to live. So I've really tried to take another tack very consciously and accept that, of course, anything I'm going to do is going to be full of flaws and things aren't going to work, and that's kind of life and that's art, but I'm going to try to enjoy it the best I can, and if I don't really want to do it. I mean, I just don't want to, and I think it's because it came from watching him. It was like, he not only was a tortured artist, but I felt like he almost played the role of a tortured artist in his life.
Right.
It felt like his life was a lot less fun because of it. I mean, it was something that even he recognized near the end of his life, and we talked about a lot. Because I think after after my mom died, he was kind of remarkable, my dad, that way. When he was 80 years old, my mom died, and he went into therapy, and really heavy-duty therapy, and he really, a lot of things changed for him, which was kind of a great life lesson, that you could be 80 years old and kind of change as a human being, and I think he kind of realized that he made himself more unhappy than he needed to be. And so I've tried my best, sometimes successfully, sometimes not, to not fall into that trap. And so that when I look at whatever, something like the chocolate board, it's like, yeah, there's moments I go, oh, that's embarrassing, but I try to feel it with a smile as opposed to with dread.
I have to ask you about Bud Cort, because my niece is in love with him. She's 20, and she discovered Harold and Maude through me, and so I have to bring him up briefly.
Harold and Maude was my very, very, very favorite film, so having him in my first movie was really exciting.
Yeah,
that was a case where that was the guy who financed the film, Jonathan Crane, had a management company, and Bud was one of his clients. And so he basically said, is there any way you could find something for Bud in the movie? And I was like, really? I mean, Bud Cort, a hero. So there was this role that I thought he could be terrific for, and I had no idea if he'd want to do it. I mean, it's funny, because I think Jonathan, the producer manager, you know, acted with feeling like, well, I'm kind of forcing this on you, and I felt like, dude, you're giving me a gift. And I actually kind of blew it with Bud, because I was so I was such a huge fan that I kept saying, look, I want you to do whatever you want with this. I'm not even gonna write the dialogue. You just kind of improvise it. And no, I want you to write the dialogue. And it took me so long to realize, no, he really wanted me to write the dialogue. I think he felt like too insecure to just improvise it. And I think he was actually quite pissed at me finally. And I felt so bad looking back. I was like, I thought I was being like really cool and like, oh no, you're Bud Cort. Just do it. And he was like, that's not how I work. And it was a bit of a lesson in sort of, yeah, be careful when you're giving a gift artistically that you're giving a gift that the person wants. And I've learned that several times. I've had to be reminded of that over the years by people. You know, because every actress particularly is so, there's such a huge range to what works for an actor, that a gift for actor A is a curse for actor B, and vice versa. And I have to keep relearning to be very careful about that. I went through that with Malcolm McDowell. I directed him in a little TV thing, and again, he was another big hero of mine. And you know, not only Top Garbage, but If and A Lucky Man is one of my very favorite movies. All these things I loved, and again, I really backed off when I was directing him. I was really like, look, go wherever you want. Finally, like the second day, he's like, darling, just give me line readings, and then I'll make them my own. And I was like, what? Give me line readings? And he's like, and I did, and it worked for him. It was great, you know. But I was so like, never would have done that, except that he was smart enough that he actually just asked for what he needed.
Right.
And it wasn't like he would just imitate what I did, but he'd use that, and then he'd kind of find it his way there. But it was a huge lesson in kind of, don't assume that other people see freedom the way you see freedom. Freedom is very individual and subjective, so.
Okay, that's the first part of my conversation with Keith Gordon. Next part is less about Keith's career. We get more into the meat and potatoes of liminalism, entertainment as propaganda, artistic expression, compromise, all kinds of very juicy stuff. So I do encourage you to check out part two. I'm going to thank some donators now. Timu and Balaz, Susan Frey, many, many thanks for the support. I'm going to mention a friend, Mario, who is in some dire straits. I'm going to blog about Mario so that people can hear the full story, but the short version is that he is currently mostly paralyzed and apparently in very critical condition and needing some support, some financial support in order to have an operation. I'm going to do what I can to help Mario to get the medical attention that he needs, even if it's only just by letting other people know. And you never know, there might be a wave of benevolence. Even just a positive thought, I think, can amount to something. So I just wanted to mention that. If you want to know more about Mario and how he got to be the way he is currently, and how that pertains to my own journey, back in my time in Guatemala, Mario was one of my close cohorts during that particularly turbulent period of my life. I will write a little bit about it on my blog anyway, and link to the fundraising project that his mother has set up for Mario. In the meantime, if anyone would like to contribute to Mario's cause, they can donate to me the usual method and just mention there that the donation is for Mario.
Watch them fall. Don't run from the light. Be your own foes and be your own guide. The ghosts from the past won't be by your side. Never mind about the way it should be done. There's a servant waiting around for